Supatipanno yassa bhagavato savaka sangho dhammayang bhagavantang sadhammang sasangang ime hi sakare hi atarahang avopite hi apipujayama saduno bante bhagava suchira parinibhutopi pachima janata nukampamanasa ime sakare dukata panna kala bhute patiganhatu amhaka dikharata hitaya sukhaya alahang samma sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi. Suvakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namassami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangang namami. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Itipiso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho vija charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purissa dhamma sarati satta deva manu sanang buddho bhagava dhammahang bhagavantam abhipujayami dhammahang bhagavantam sirasa namami. Suvakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehi passiko opanayiko pachatang veditabo vinyuhi dhammahang dhammang abhipujayami dhammahang dhammang sirasa namami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaditam Chatavi Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttarang Punya Ketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami.
Now the Metta Sutta in English.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings they may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding into false use. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Very good. We have a visiting monk this evening, Venerable Sudassi. He's staying for a little while in the Cambodian Vihara in Scotland. Okay, now we have the questions. Da-da-da. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how are you? So-so. Okay. More than a year I have been to the temple, made merit, kept the precepts, and my life is much better. Yay. I miss my cat. I am on retreat. Thank you. I'm sure your cat will be okay. I think that's what it says. But anyway, sometimes animals, if they really miss you, then maybe they might come here and see you. That happens. I told you about that cat, Kit Kat. We used to have this cat here years and years and years and years ago. And it was born over in Bodhinyana Monastery in a log. It's a little kitten. Very smart. But cats are not good in the forest, because they eat so many birds and destroy so much natural wildlife. So even though we liked it, someone suggested putting a bell around its neck, but then the only bell which worked was that big bell in the bell house opposite the... But that was a bit too much. So decided one day to find the cat a nice home. And so we found a cat a nice home. And sometimes as a Buddhist monk, you don't want to harm any sort of animals, you know, especially animals who've learned how to trust you. So what happened next was I decided we had to find it this home. So I was the one who sort of patted it and then put it in the bag. I felt really guilty about that. And then just put the bag in the back seat of the car, and this lady drove it all the way to Waterman's. That's north of the river, by the coast. So we took it out there. I never went. It's the first time the cat had ever been in the metropolitan area. The furthest that he'd ever been before was in Byford, you know, to get monasticized. So they wouldn't have any kittens. So it was a nice female cat. But then after we took it up to Waterman's, the lady there kept it in the house for 3 days. And then afterwards she let it out. And it was during the summertime. She let it out, I think, on a Saturday. And Saturday afternoon. And of course the cat bolted for the gate. And she couldn't catch it. So it ran down the road, and then she got in her car looking for it. And she looked a long time, and then she finally called me at Nolamara Temple later on, a few hours later, said, "I'm terribly sorry, Ajahn Brahm. I've lost your cat. I can't find it anywhere." And I happily told her, "Don't worry, it's here with me in Nolamara." She couldn't believe it. I think she came out to check. Because what happened, 2 hours, that's all it took from this cat to go from Waterman's to Nolamara. I think it's about 7, 8, 9 kilometers or something. over the freeway. And he didn't have any GPS or iPhone or anything to help if he got lost. It's the first time he's ever been in the city of Perth. And it was remarkable because I just happened to be, I think, after the talk in the after the meditation in the afternoon, I think it was, I was just by the door when I heard, this was the old door before we got the glass doors that's in Nolamara, the wooden door. I heard this meowing outside the door and opened the door, and it was this Kit Kat. And the poor cat, his paws were so hot. You could feel it. It wasn't burnt. It was, it managed to survive. But I just gave it all this milk. Just bottles of it, because it was so thirsty. It'd take the whole lot. And then it just curled up or sat down, because it must be really tired, on the chair which Ajahn Chacko used to sit in. And it peed all over it. But I thought, fair enough. It had, and also just, it had almost like earned its place in Bodhidharma. You couldn't get rid of it. But what a smart cat that was. Instead of going from Waterman's to Nolamara, which would have taken it days, it just went straight for me in sort of Nolamara temple. Never been there before in its life. And to this day, how can it do that? But anyway, it did that, and so it came back and stayed here for many more years. And eventually, when it did die, it got buried. There's a Bodhi tree just behind the main hall of Bodhinyana. We buried it there, little Kit Kat. Anyway, there's a nice little story there that sometimes you might miss your cat. Sometimes the cat follows you. And how it gets there, how it knows where you are, I don't know. And it's smart, it gets the quickest way. Anyway, Ajahn, I'm wondering why you chose Theravada Buddhism as opposed to any other type of Buddhism. Thanks. That is an interesting question, and the reason is a very obvious one. Over in London, there was many different types of Buddhism, many different types of teachers, and the reason I chose Theravada Buddhism, especially that was the Thai Buddhism, because in the temples I went to listen to talks, it was the Thai monks who smiled the most. Honestly, because I thought if practicing Buddhism, practicing the Dhamma, is going to make you peaceful and happy. I knew enough about Buddhism then to realize you should be able to see that happiness and see that stillness and the calmness. And that's where I saw the most. There were Sri Lankan monks around, but in the Sri Lankan temple, I was really disappointed when I found out where it was. But it was really in my suburb. It was in Chiswick. And that's where, I went to school in Hammersmith, just down the road. And my parents lived in Acton, which is just north of Chiswick. But I never saw those monks at all. And one of the reasons is because whenever they would go anywhere, they get in the car, they drive, or they'd be driven to the destination, they get out. You never actually saw them on the streets. And if I'd have seen them, I'd have, gone there. It was just so close by. It's my local temple. But that's one of the reasons now you always like the monks to walk. Go an arms round. If they want to go for a walk around Nolamara, yes, please go. Let the locals see you. And don't always go in a car. It's very hard for me to do that these days. Even sometimes. Sometimes I don't tell you that I'm going to walk from here to monastery. It's only a short way. You know what happens? Someone sees me and they come in, oh, we'll give you a lift. Please don't do that, especially if it's in the city. Let the monks be seen. let the nuns be seen. That's one of the reasons why, if ever I do go overseas, even like to places like Sydney, that you can get a train just from the airport, and you get these little oyster cards, no, not oyster cards, forget what they are, octopus or something cards. And you know, the people offer them to you, and then you can actually go in the train. And the same within in London. Just, it's hard sometimes to actually, people say, oh no, we'll pick you up. And I much, much prefer to go on the train so people can see you. And you get those like lovely conversations, like the the spaghetti and the and was it macaroni conversation. It's lovely being able to do that on trains because you're available, you're open. And it'd be the sort of thing I would have thought if the Buddha was alive, he'd encourage his monks and nuns actually to go on those public transport to be seen. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why I became a monk in Thailand, because I thought they were happiest. I did see some Tibetan monks, but the Tibetan monks, they were number two. But the Theravada monks, you know, they looked the more happy, the more peaceful. It was like whenever you buy like a toothpaste or something, you want to buy the toothpaste which makes your teeth whiter. I wanted to join the Buddhism which made me more peaceful. That's the only reason why. Do you have to know and understand the Buddha's teachings to be able to meditate effectively or the right way? You have to know enough of those Buddha's teachings. Not all of them. And you have to know how to be peaceful. Remember when I started meditating, that I was told some of those Buddha's teachings. I was lucky to have a pretty good teacher who said, he said to me, he said, I'm teaching meditation so you can achieve the first jhana. And I thought, wow. At the time I didn't realize, I thought everyone taught meditation that way. But that was actually an amazing sort of teacher. So it was a great thing to learn. But there are many different types of meditation, but it doesn't matter. Because you start meditating, you discover many things yourself, and also you can check up on many other teachers and find the one which actually suits you and also which actually feels right. And later on, you learn on the way. So you don't know know and understand all the Buddha's teachings to be able to meditate effectively, just enough of them to get started. And just like one of the favorite sayings of mine, sorry, not of mine, of the Buddha, was that whatever Dhamma or Vinaya is our training, which leads, you know, certainly to, what is it, to Nibbida, you're turning away from the world, to things disappearing, to your life simplifying, to things ceasing, not more things happening, but your life like losing things, and to, you know, in a good way, to peace, upasama, and to the, what's the other ones? Sorry? Yeah. I was already mentioned viraga, yeah. Fading away. To Nirodha cessation, yes, right, and to Sambodhi, to enlightenment, and to Nibbana. So those teachings you can know for sure are the teachings of the Buddha, the Vinaya of the Buddha. And he said that to Mahaprajapati, the first bhikkhuni, and also to Upali, who was his barber before. And those teachings there, it's almost, it was not so specific. It was this general, you know the teachings by how they work. They make you peaceful. So you may have some teachings that makes you tense. That can't be the teaching of the Buddha. It makes you just more arrogant. That can't be the teaching of the Buddha. It makes you accumulate more things, like huge, big monasteries. That can't be the teachings of the Buddha. If it leads to simplicity, it leads to things vanishing and you just having less things to worry about. That must be the teachings of the Buddha and the Vinaya of the Buddha. So instead of having to learn all of these rules and stuff, I did learn all those rules. I did sort of learn Pali and the Patimokkha, of course, and also the suttas. But what actually leads to peace and stillness, to calm? That's upasama. When things get so still and peaceful. It's one of my favorite words. When things get very quiet and calm. Just like you can feel in jhana growth. It's a very calm and peaceful place. So this is an expression of the Dhamma and the Vinaya. And eventually it leads to things disappearing. That's the viraga. And things ceasing. Your body vanishes. Your mind gets incredibly still and peaceful. Things stop, cease. That's the Buddha's teachings. That's really what you really need to know. Hopefully that makes sense to you. Okay, how can we have good meditations when our bodies and minds are under the influence of such things as medication or hormones? Your body's under those influence, but not your mind. That's the wonderful thing to know about the mind. It is distinct from your body in the sense that, seen this so many times, that this is like the terminal lucidity phenomena. And this is when a person is very sick. Sometimes they put you in a coma. Or sometimes you may have dementia. And then for some reason, just before you pass away, you can remember everything. You're clear-minded. And that's happened many, many times. And I've said this often, but the usual story I mention is one of these stories told me by one of the doctors who goes to Nalamara Center. He said, when I gave a talk about that, he came up afterwards and said, yes, you know, I had this experience of that a few days before. One of his patients, terminally ill, but the death process started earlier than expected. So he rushed to the bedside and realized the patient was really going fast. So no need to, couldn't stop at the death process. So what he did, it's already planned, the patient had the list of phone numbers in the book next to the bed. And so he started ringing, calling all the close relations, one by one. So you better come quick to the hospital, you know, your husband's dying, your son's dying, or whatever. And he got to one of the daughters. For some reason, I still remember the name, Julie. called Julie. Julie answered, Julie, you better come to the hospital quick. Your dad's dying. And before he could put down the phone, so the dad opened his eyes, turned around, and said, please tell Julie, my daughter, how much I love her. And then he passed away. And it was just totally impossible that he could do that. He was either, I think he was drugged to his eyeballs, probably with morphine, and in a coma, hadn't opened his eyes for days. Well, not days, but anyway, for many hours. And that's a common phenomenon. It's not always happened, but it happens quite regularly, you know, to many people. Because I remember asking in Singapore, and in the hospital there, how many of you doctors and nurses involved in palliative care have witnessed that? And about a third of the doctors and nurses put their hand up. They'd witnessed it. So it's something which is weird. How can that happen? The brain is either dead or it's so drugged to its, drugged to its eyeballs, but it's so drugged that it's impossible that you should be able to say anything. But then these people, they open their eyes and start speaking. What's going on? The way I understand it, the brain is just not functioning anymore. You're very close to death, but the mind can take over. And it's that mind which takes over, which receives the messages, and which actually makes the body talk. In the same way of those kids who can speak. I mentioned that to you before. I've collected a few cases of children just born a couple of weeks old who speak. And now, the first people who told us this was when Ajahn Chakra was still here, and it was an Australian family. They weren't Buddhist at all, but they heard their kid speak when it was just born, a couple of weeks old. It just spoke to its elder brother, you know, "Good night, Peter," in an adult voice. And that really shocked them. And they came to the monks because they thought the monks might have some explanation to this. They didn't tell anybody else because they thought they'd be crazy. But anyway, that collected more evidence of kids speaking. And many times people don't want to report that because they think that people won't believe them or they'll think they imagined it. But one of the best cases, most interesting cases, was reported in the US. Apparently it was true. That this kid was born in the maternity ward, and the doctors and midwives or whatever, nurses saw it, heard it, and as soon as the baby came out of the room, the baby, it looked around and said, "Oh no, not again." And to me, I thought, you know, that's what a good Buddhist would say if you get really bored and you can speak, "Oh no, not again." But do you know anyone else who spoke when they were born? The Buddha when he was born, or the Buddha-to-be. And so sometimes I thought, when I was a Westerner, an academic, Cambridge University and all that, when I first heard that, I thought, that's just embellishments. When you hear stories of people talking when they were born, maybe it's true. And of course, no, you know it was true. Amazing. So, your bodies may be sick, but your mind does not need to be sick. That was a saying of the Buddha, and it's much deeper and more profound than most people imagine. Though your body is sick, the mind doesn't need to be sick. The mind is really powerful. You said that there is no wisdom without jhana. No, the Buddha said that. Sounds fair enough. Then you said there is no jhana without wisdom. Okay. And that some people can be wise but not have jhana. Did I say that? If they were wise, would they not have jhana? What kind of wisdom do they have? Are they just born that way? Like some people are just smart or good at sport. How do you acquire wisdom? Real wisdom is, you know, from experience. That's why that book, which I might mention, Emotional Intelligence, rather than Intellectual Intelligence, which is the best. Because, you know, we measure IQ, but have you got a measure for emotional intelligence? I remember just a story about that. There was this Vietnamese migrant who came to Australia, and, you know, when he went to school, he asked his daddy, you know, what does IQ mean? And his father said, IQ is a measure of your, you know, intelligence, your smartness. So if you've got an IQ of, so 100, that's the average person. 120, you're really intelligent, and you'll probably get a good job. 140, you'll probably go to university. If you have an IQ of 80, you know, you're not that smart. If you have an IQ of only, say, 60, you're so stupid you can't even tie up your own bootlaces. And the kid replied, "Oh, is that the reason why most Australians wear thongs?" Okay, that's a racist joke. But that was said by this Vietnamese comic. It was an Ang Go or something. Apparently he used to be on the TV or something. Ungo?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But he was very, very funny when he said things like that. Okay, here we go. You can take this off, this one. He's also one of his favourite jokes is when he first came to Australia. He saw the hot dogs. He said, oh, that's homegrown food. Because sometimes the people in Vietnam, any Vietnamese here, I'm going to get in big trouble. Okay. I think it's only good fun. And he said, oh, dogs. So, hot dogs. I said, oh, just Vietnamese food. And he went there and he saw the hot dog and he said, you know, even in Vietnam, we don't eat that part of the dog. Please take that off the record. I couldn't resist this, sorry. Anyway, but the emotional intelligence is actually something which is much more powerful than the ordinary intelligence. You feel truths. So with the jhanas, they actually give your mind the wisdom which is free from the five hindrances. You see, not what you've been taught, not what you've learnt, but you see much deeper than that. That's one of the reasons why, unfortunately, in many universities, we teach people knowledge, not wisdom. Teach people facts, not how to question those facts. Now, as being a scientist, I always remembered they had this Royal Society in London, and one of the persons who founded that Royal Society, I think it was Francis Bacon, and he was also a philosopher, and he said the only way you should run the inquiry into science is a way of negativity. Put your theories up and try your hardest to disprove them. Don't try to prove them. And if you try every means possible of disproving that, and you can't, that's proof. Tentatively. Until someone comes up with a theory or with an experiment which disproves it, that is the way forward. But these days, most people, they just tend to have a theory and spend billions proving it by trying their hardest to disprove it. Because many research grants, many sort of reputations, many sort of advancements in your reputation or career depend upon you publishing new proofs of your theories. We never try to disprove them anymore. I remember reading that when I started science. People always trying to prove the latest theory, never trying to disprove it. And I remember that also when there was a book written recently by Rupert Sheldrake. And I remember he did a TED talk about the book, about the delusions of science. And one of them, which he said, was just questioning everything. You know that there is just a basic law of gravity. And if you know that law of gravity, that the attraction between objects, this is Newton's law, attraction between objects is the multiple of their masses divided by the square of the distance apart times this thing called big G, the universal gravitational constant. And Sheldrake was saying, is the big G constant? It's assumed to be constant. It's one of the assumptions of physics. But he was checking all of these research facilities which actually measure big G regularly all over the world. And it changes significantly. Not a small amount. And that really made me listen because I still remember one of my mentors in science, one who really inspired me, was again the previous Lucasian professor of physics, who was a guy called Fred Hoyle. Fred Hoyle had this very thick northern accent, and he, you know, came from a poor background. He was not one of the elite coming from big public schools, but he was absolutely brilliant. And I remember going to one of his lectures. I got the time wrong, which was lucky. I got there an hour earlier, and that's why I could get a seat. And this was in the biggest lecture theatre in Cambridge. It was, I think, the Chemical Laboratories Lecture Theatre. And the place was totally packed. And it was like going to see the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. The whole audience was electrified by this guy. And he was such an amazing lecturer. And he could really relate, you know, his ideas to the audience. And he was totally destroying all your ideas of what physics was. And one of them was, big G, why does it have to be constant? What would happen if it wasn't constant? Why do we assume all these things? He got kicked out later on because it was too controversial for them. But later on, what he said, Rupert Sheldrake was confirming. And now anyone who knows any science, if they do find that something like that fundamental law of physics which you talk about in schools and you assume is true, you actually doubt that, and that is just undermines much of physics. He says it's an assumption which can be proved not to be true. But instead of accepting that, it's just too much hard work. It's just looked upon as a weird case, and people don't take it seriously. So sometimes I always like the idea, always question even some of your basic assumptions. And if you do, that's where you get the strength and courage to really have the emotional wisdom. You're not sort of accepting what people say. You're seeing much deeper than that. I always liked that in science. But all those heroes who did question, they usually got sort of kicked out or ignored. But then you come to Buddhism, and you are allowed to ask questions. You are permitted to challenge. And you are, can experience deeper. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. So that is actually how you become wise, to challenge. And that is also one of the reasons why that, you know, I just encourage questions. And the reason behind that is, I think is the Kamu Bhanga Sutta somewhere, where somebody came to see the Buddha. Did I say this already? I think I did in brief. Someone came to see the Buddha and said, asked him many questions. One of them was, why are some people born rich? And whatever you do, it turns into money, even if you don't inherit it. Why is it that some people are poor, even though you work really hard? You know, really, really hard, but you can never actually pay the bills, and you're always just struggling to get by. What karma did you do in your past life to be poor in this one? And the Buddha said, because you don't put enough money in the donation box. But then it gets it more interesting. Why are some people born beautiful while other people are born ugly? It doesn't matter how much plastic surgery they get, how much makeup, how much time they go to the spa, they're still ugly. So what do you have to do to be beautiful in this life? If you haven't seen me do this story before, when I say the word ugly, and these days even beautiful, I always put my vision on the floor. Because it really did happen, not making this up. I said the word ugly when I happened to, in Singapore, when I just happened to be looking at one of the people in the audience. And they complained. Why did you say the word ugly, Ajahn Brahm, when you were looking at me? So being a monk, you also make sure you say the word beautiful. You don't look at anybody. You might get the wrong idea. But anyway, you know, to be sort of beautiful, it depends upon your sila, being a good person, keeping your precepts. It does give you this beautiful character. Anyway, the main one was, why are some people intelligent and other people are stupid? And that was the one where the Buddha said, if you ask questions in your previous life, then you'd be intelligent in this life. And even in this life, to ask questions. That's the cause of the wisdom. You don't just believe and just accept because you have faith in Ajahn Brahm or whoever. You actually keep questioning. And you've got a devotion to truth. It doesn't matter how much it costs, how much ideas and attachments you have to abandon. If this is the truth, you'll accept it. Some people don't want to learn the truth because it hurts sometimes. But after a while you think, no, I need to know. And I need to accept that truth, no matter what it is. That's why I said it needs courage. And that's, you know, what the Buddha did. And finding that truth, and other people didn't accept it, didn't believe it, eventually found out to be true. Anyway, Ajahn, you mentioned yesterday about Pure Land in Mahayana. They have a few realms in Mahayana. You know what Mahayana is, don't you? Now, we want to try and connect to all types of Buddhism. So, he got the H from Hinayana, Aha from Mahayana, and Yana from Vajrayana. Bit of each. And it sounds Mahayana. That's it, you're a Mahayana practitioner. Anyway, are these the same as the Theravada? Oh no, this is Mahayana, he said not Mahayana. Are these the same as Theravada? How does Mahayana differ from Theravada? Why did you choose Theravada? Again, it's because the monks which I saw seem to be living most simply. You know what sometimes really turns me off? I don't know, maybe because I was born in the West, going to some of the temples, which are just so wealthy, but then outside people are poor. And this actually was the Thai temple in Bodh Gaya. I remember just going in there, and it was just so opulent. And it was actually funded, you know, by the King of Thailand at the time. And I was invited, I can stay there if I wanted. I said, no, I don't want to. But then went into the Sri Lankan temple there. In the Sri Lankan temple, they had a pharmacy giving out medicines and a school for orphan kids. And, you know, this was Bodh Gaya, that area was just so poor. And so the monks there, just you looked at their temple, they're falling apart, really dacky, because all the money they were getting, they were giving it to people who really needed it. And I, you know, felt a bit sad that I was a Thai monk ordained in Thailand. Over there, the Sri Lankans, amazing, well done. In other places, you build big temples. And you don't need a big temple. Comfortable temple, yeah. But not embellished with too much gold and stuff when other people outside are poor. Now that's, you saw my cave today. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to live in a simple place like a cave was a vow which I made when I became a monk. I said, I don't want to live in accommodation which is more luxurious than the poorest of my supporters. I felt guilty that some people just, you know, feed me. And I live in a sort of a mansion which, you know, they could even dream of living in. So, you know, keep it simple if you're a monk or a nun. So anyway, that's why the cave is just nice and simple. So why I chose Theravada was simple, and later on you found it's actually more authentic, more original Buddhism. And you went to see someone like an Ajahn Chah's, amazing the kindness which he had. But the one thing about Ajahn Chah which really inspired me was after many years of being his disciple, you know, going and listening to him teach, one day, so I was sitting with many other monks just outside his hut listening to his teachings, and he asked me just to go upstairs to his private quarters to get something up there. And I was really excited. This was the first time I could go into Ajahn Chah's personal room and actually see how he lived. And I went in there, that was the one time which I really respected my teacher. There's hardly anything there. There's not a mattress there, even though it was old. It was a grass mat. Not even an ordinary pillow. There was a wooden pillow. And on the line there was just one spare robe. And I think that was about it. It was so empty. And he was this famous monk who, like, kings and queens were visiting him. And that's all he had. He could have so many luxuries, things there. He had such little stuff. And I thought, wow, that was someone who knew the importance of simplicity. That's why I wanted to stay with such monks. Simple monks. Dear Ajahn, how do we know that we have overcome sense desires? Can you give examples for all five senses? Yes, I can, but not now. Well, the question was, can I? Have you overcome sense desires? If you've overcome one, you've overcome them all. So in other words, when you see the sense desires are not going to fulfill and what they promise, that they are unfaithful to you. They promise that once you get this... I remember just, you know, when I was a monk, especially when I came over here, I thought, what I would really like is to get some fish and chips, hot, just to see what they really like again. Because every time you had them in the monastery, you always had other things on top of them. And so, at last, I had to go to perform a funeral service. And on the way back, there wasn't enough time to actually to get the food back in Bodhinyana Monastery. So Ajahn Jagua gave me permission, I'll just get the driver to get you something on the way. So I planned it all. Right, this is the time. I'm going to get some real fish and chips, hot. And so I went into Byford. We got these fish and chips. For the first time, I thought, I am going to fulfill my dream and my fantasy. And so I went up there, I think into the hills, there's a nice quiet spot with the driver to eat them. And I had this terrible tummy ache afterwards. I was glad I did that because I realized that the desires were unfaithful to me. You thought they'd be so nice and delicious, but they weren't. So I'm glad I did that because it taught me a lesson. All those things which you fantasize about, when you actually get them, they don't satisfy you. So that's why sometimes people get a new car, a new house, a new, I don't know what, new something or other. But it's never enough. It just makes you want more. That's why letting go, giving up, is the way to freedom. You learn the freedom from desires instead of the freedom of desires. Ajahn Brahm, I know you were a gifted soccer player. Gifted? I don't know. But you know, the one thing I didn't like about playing soccer was, in fact, the very last game I played was when only 9 of the other side turned up, and there was 11 in my team. And because there was 11 in my team, that it was just so one-sided, it was unfair. And even just at half-time, I think it was about 6-0 ahead, which was, you know, just a stupid game. And I went up to the captain of my side, and I said, "Would you mind if I played for the other team in the second half?" And he thought I was crazy and mad. He said, "No, but it's not a good game at all. It's so one-sided." He said, "No, you have to play for your college. You can't play for the other college." And so that's the last game I played. I gave up after that. It's not winning. It was just the exercise which I was in for. And it's the same with exams, I often say. I hated exams because I knew the answers. My friend didn't. When I tried to help him, I said, "This is the answer." That was called cheating. I called it compassion. But can you teach us about AFL? Yes. AFL is acknowledge, forgive, learn. In other words, you make a mistake, please let the people closest to you know, and always have it forgiven. So you're not afraid of making mistakes, and you learn from them. I did mention to you that the other day I didn't have any lunch because I went out to do a wedding ceremony for a couple. They invited me a long time ago. They couldn't get anybody else, so I went out to teach them the AFL code. I said, "Look, you're married. So from now on, if you make a mistake, please make sure that your partner understands that any mistake you make, you can tell them. So, they know what's going on. You did something wrong." The only way that you'll be able to be confident enough you can tell your partner is you know that you'll always be forgiven. There'll always be sort of amnesty. And then you can actually learn to try and do it better next time. And instead of just trying that by yourself, you have your partner to help you. I said, "Look, two young people, if you go to work and you like somebody in the office or somebody in the office tries to flirt with you, what do you do?" Tell your wife, tell your husband. Share that information. And then learn how the both of you can support each other, even when you work in different departments or different places. Because you need both of you to help. Or later on when you have kids. That story about this Sri Lankan girl many years ago, and she came to see me. She wanted to speak to me. She said she was in big trouble. She was about 18 or something, maybe 18, 19. I said, "What's the trouble?" And she said, "I'm pregnant with her boyfriend." "Have you told your mum and dad?" And she said, "No, they'll kill me." I said, "That's why I come to you. Can you please tell my mum and dad for me?" And when they actually said that, I was both felt privileged that I could be of service to her, but also quite worried. Why is it that when your kids really need you, they're afraid to tell you? The people who can help them the most, they won't go to, they won't see them. A child gets involved, a boy gets involved in drugs, or the girl gets pregnant or something. Why can't you go and see your mum and dad and say, "Mum, look, this is what's happened. Please help me." He said, "You stupid girl, I'll never let you go out again. You can't go to that place anymore." They don't want to be afraid of you. They want to be understood that they made a mistake. And you're there to help them, not to criticize them and to punish them. Otherwise, they will never go to you again. So really, that's the AFL code. And it's really good, so I can tell those parents, "Look, your daughter made a big mistake. And, mistakes happen in life. So please be kind to her." But then I told many other people of that story, and I was quite distressed that children feel they have to hide the truth from their parents because they're afraid of the consequences. Instead, parents should be there to love their kids. As my father said, "Son, the door of my heart's always open to you, no matter what you ever do." That's the attitude which I was encouraging for people in the family, the AFL code. Then people make far less mistakes. That's the AFL code. It seems that an attitude or relationship of kindness towards everything that arises is key to the proper practice that frees. Please can you say more about how the formal practice of loving kindness metta meditation can help develop such right motivation or way of relating to life? Yes, it does work, and sometimes when you do loving kindness meditation, it also gives you a lot of bliss as well. That's one of the reasons why I don't teach metta meditation too much. I will do it at the end of the retreat because that's been the custom. But sometimes if I try teaching that loving kindness during the middle, it's too powerful for me. Sometimes I can't teach it anymore. I can practice it. It's like one of the chants we used to do. And I asked Ajahn Jaco, "Can we please not do that anymore?" He said, "Why?" It's because I only got to the, about a quarter of the way through it. And I was just blissing out. I couldn't chant anymore. Because, you know what the words mean. And you just follow it. It's just too powerful for me. I'm spreading loving kindness to all the four quarters and up and down all over the place. And that just, it kind of grabs me. And it's just so wonderful and so delightful to do. But it doesn't matter, because everything which we do here, even just the body scan or the loving kindness or letting go of the past and the future, always mention that's with loving kindness. It's so much easier to let go of the past if you're kind to the past. So much easier to be in the present if you're kind to the present. So much easier to relax the body if you're kind to it. And then you learn what kindness is. Because it's what relaxes and eases everything off. And sometimes people don't understand what kindness is. I've seen people doing the loving kindness meditation. "May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering." But when you understand what it really is, it's very powerful. And even I thought of doing this morning, but just I was got onto other things. There was once when I was over in teaching a weekend retreat in Safety Bay, and I was tired and wondering what should I do to teach meditation this evening, and I decided to teach the combination of loving kindness and breath meditation. And that's really powerful. You're watching your breath with this wonderful loving kindness. "May my breath be happy and well. May my breath be free of any force or any difficulties. I've been breathing for so many years and it's never let me down. And it's served me so much and allowed me to do so much good, like building monasteries and stuff and ordaining bhikkhunis and goodness knows what else. Thank you, breath." And so much loving kindness towards it. It was just so easy to watch my breath go in and out. It was just like watching this beautiful, beautiful thing inside of me, which was always there, but I was taking for granted. And the breath was so beautiful, so lovely, that I just blissed out again. But I remember that night because I started dreaming of jhanas. And if you really dream of those things, you don't sleep very much. And it's a beautiful night. But it's powerful teachings. If you know what it means, oh, really good. And if you do loving kindness meditation, often you get these wonderful nimittas come up. And they're like golden, like suns. Beautiful colour. And because they're so attractive, you know, they pull you towards them. So maybe I don't do that enough as teaching. I practice it, because sometimes I would just disappear. I won't come out of meditation until after the retreat. So, sorry if I don't do it too often. Ah, you've got me going again now. It does develop incredible motivation. It's very, very powerful if you do it properly. Thank you for the opportunity to visit your cave and Bodhinyana Monastery. Your bedroom is even smaller than our cottage room. Yeah. Such a privilege to see many great monks' relics in the upper stair hall. Well, yeah. Why are the relics all of different shape? How are they formed? Are there securities to protect them? I think they are highly valuable. They're not highly valuable, they're invaluable. It's one of the reasons why we just keep them so people can see them. That's one of the other things which I was rebelling against. Sometimes you have like relics, especially of the Buddha. Sometimes you can't even see them. You got the great sort of tooth relic over in Sri Lanka. And you know, even though I'm a well-known monk and can actually get inside the chamber, you can't actually see the relic itself. And I wasn't going to argue with anybody. But it's much better to be able to have those relics, which you've seen, over there, visible to people. So that you can actually have a good look at them. And some of those relics are fantastic. One of the things with relics, you know they're relics, because sometimes, of those relics, I remember just giving a small portion, only two relics, to the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. And they, you know, they accepted them just out of respect for me, not out of any respect for the Buddha, I'm being honest. Because they didn't believe in relics, that was just superstition. But it was only about a month it took, and they emailed me, said, "Ajahn Bhong wouldn't believe this, I had little photographs. There's now three relics in there, and no one had touched them." It's as if, where on earth did they come from? There's only two before, now there's three. And that convinced them there's more going on in even things like relics than you'd ever imagine. And even over in the Buddhist Society of Victoria, I remember one of the presidents there, he was given some relics for the temple. And instead of actually taking them to the temple, he just put them in his cupboard, you know, at home. Meaning to take them there later, but forgot all about them. When he remembered about a year later, he looked at the relic casket, they were empty. Another lady, down over in Manjimup, she was given three relics. This was by the Thai monk Ajahn Tate, who visited years ago. And when he gave them, she put them on a shrine, she looked after them, but then after a while, the marriage she had with her husband broke up, and so she couldn't look after the house, you know, totally. So she got somebody in to renovate the main room where the shrine was. And the builder knocked over the shrine without telling her. And he just put it back again. He didn't realize how important it was. And so he, later on, she vacuumed the carpet before she found there was two of the relics were missing. And oh my goodness, they must have been vacuumed up. But she was such a faithful Buddhist, she's a Westerner, that she went through the compost pile where all of the stuff in the vacuum cleaner was put, with a tea strainer. And for days and days and days, and she finally found one of those relics, but one was missing. And she strained everything, she couldn't find it. I remember Ajahn Chakra visited her and told her, you know, that, well, you know, it wasn't your intention, it should be okay, but who knows, it might come back again. And then later on, I visited her. I remember the time I visited her because, you know, she was watching the news, and that was the time of the Tiananmen massacre in Beijing. She's saying how terrible it was. But anyway, sometime around that time, I visited her. And she just talked about this one evening. And I said, have they come back yet? She said, no. I said, when was the last time you checked? Can I have a look? And I opened it up. How many do you see? One, two, three. They'd come back. And she was very restrained. She just stopped talking to me and went to her desk and wrote a little letter, you know, confirming what had just happened. She was really gobsmacked. Where it came back from, who knows, but they had returned. You may believe me, you may not believe me, but this is what happens. And I was a scientist. You've got to follow the evidence. Somehow they came back. Anyway. You know, one of the best for the relics is we got some, because I heard this, I mean, I did my research, I'm always a bit sort of dubious about relics, but I know that according to the tradition, that when the Buddha passed away and was cremated at Kusinara, his relics were divided into 8 portions, and the ashes were for the person who did the chanting, say, or collected the ashes. And they were distributed to to 8 of the capitals where the Buddha was connected to. That's places like Sarvati and obviously Benares and Rajagaha. But one of those places where they were put was his birthplace, Kapalavatthu. And according to the history, that Kapalavatthu was destroyed shortly after the Buddha's passing away. And that's why, you know, there's lots of, even now, debate upon where Kapalavatthu was located. The Indians say it's on the Indian side of the border. The Nepalese say it's on their side of the border. Because, you know, the whole city was destroyed. So Kapalavatthu. And so, that later on, the Emperor Asoka located as many of those relics as he could and distributed them even further afield. But later, in the British Raj time, one of the local district officers, you know, he did some excavations around the site which was in the Indian site. And he found a little box. And in the box were some relics and had Pali inscription on the outside. And I knew enough Pali that the inscription actually read, relics in here are in the place where the Buddha's relics are. But the person who found them just interpreted it as these are the Buddha relics. And they were taken over, if I remember correctly, to Thailand where they were enshrined in Wotsaket, in a big reliquary there. But then the head of the Indian archaeological department, you know, knew his Pali and said, this is not the interpretation, these can't be the Buddha's relics. So he dug deeper, only a foot or something, underneath where those old relics were found. And they found some more relics, the real ones. And those are now enshrined in the National Museum in New Delhi for everyone to see. In a beautiful casket. And the casket was actually offered by the King of Thailand, you know, King Bhumibol Rama the Ninth. But you can actually see them. And I'd done my research and knew that because the relics of all the other stupas have been opened up by Emperor Asoka and distributed all over the place, these were probably the original of one of those 8. And so I remember when I saw them, I got a picture of, you know, with Ajahn Appi, he was there at the time when we saw them. And other times they said, what do you want to go today? I had an extra day on the pilgrimage in India, so I want to go to the National Museum to hang out with the relics again. They're really inspiring. And they actually look, I've done many cremations over in Thailand, they actually look like relics, not sort of distributed or broken up. So if you ever really want to see what I would say the most authentic relics of the Buddha, then the National Museum in New Delhi, worth a visit. Anyway, sorry, I'll just get sort of passionate about such things. Compassionate. Okay, dear Ajahn Pong, there are very, very less questions today. I'm sorry, but I'd sort of get interested in your questions. Yeah, if time permits, can you tell some inspirational story which you haven't told in this retreat yet? Inspirational story. One of those inspirational stories. I've told about going into Ajahn Chah's hut, but it's also that inspirational story, insight story, of just the last year of Ajahn Chah, when he could actually teach and speak, that the monks, when I was involved in this, we found out that in the time of the Buddha, every monastery, most monasteries, had saunas to keep the monks healthy. So we built a sauna in Wat Banana Chat in northeast Thailand. And it was supposed to be for Ajahn Chah's health. But more than that, we knew that we could get Ajahn Chah over once a week to the monastery to give a talk. It was selfish. I admit that. But it worked so beautifully. He would come over once a week, he'd give a Dhamma talk first, and then he'd have his sauna. And this one time, he gave just a brilliant Dhamma talk. You know, sometimes you really hit the spot. And this was one of those occasions. And I was so inspired after the talk that I went round the back of the hall. Instead of doing what I would usually do, what I was expected to do, to go and help Ajahn Chah, you know, with his sauna, I went back and just meditated for a couple of hours. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why you can get lovely meditations through inspiration. And the inspiration was just so fantastic. And then the meditation was really peaceful and deep. When I came out, I didn't know what the time was. So I thought I should go and see if there's any duty I can do for my teacher. So I went towards the sauna. He'd already finished. And he was walking back with his attendant, the car driver. And we would cross on the path and we couldn't miss each other. And as he came close to me, he stopped and he looked at me. And you know, I just had this beautiful meditation. My mind was clear of hindrances. It was brilliant. And then as he looked at me, I'm saying this honestly to you, you could feel him inside your mind, checking me out. These monks could read minds. But it wasn't the sort of mind where he'd say, you're thinking of your girlfriend back in London. Nothing like that. My mind was pure. I was very happy he could, you know, go wherever he wanted in it. It was a nice mind. And so then he looked at me and said, Brahma Wangsa. Why? He asked me the question, why? He was just trying to enlighten me right there. And then I said, I don't know. A stupid answer. But whenever any of the monks did something stupid like that, he would just burst out laughing. He would not sort of, you know, criticize you or scold you. He would just laugh. When he finished laughing, and then he looked at me again and said, Brahma Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. And it was really exciting. You get this personal teaching, you know, at a time when my mind was really pure and free. You know, the answer to the question, why? In Thai, it was Tamai. And he said the answer to the question, why, was Mai Mi Arai, which in the English translation is, there's nothing. There's nothing. And then he looked at me again and said, do you understand? And I said, yes. You know what happened next? He looked at me and said, no, you don't. And he walked away. That's such inspiration, such a simple teaching, which now came about after inspiring me and having a nice deep meditation. And then you get this little bit of wisdom, this little bit of nice questioning, going right to the point. Why? There's nothing. And then it was such an important experience, you never forget it. That's why I tell it to you. The answer is, there's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. That was inspirational. I'll just do one more question and we'll finish off. There's more questions to come, I'll finish them tomorrow. Oh my good. Can you please explain a bit more about the Kasina meditation? I'd like to know the step-by-step process that has to be done tomorrow. That's more complicated. What's this one? How do we increase, improve our EQ, emotional intelligence, aside from meditation? No, you do it through meditation. It's the best. Why not meditate? Why do you want to do anything else when you're here? Anyway, that wasn't much of a question, so I'll try this one. Oh my goodness. I have had a song stuck in my head all afternoon. And it is an annoying one from a Disney movie. I thought, I am distracting myself from the moment. So I asked myself, what am I feeling? And it could be anxious. So I tried to really feel it, but it won't stop singing in my head. If thoughts are like clouds passing, do I accept today could be cloudy, stormy day and give these clouds kindness and acceptance? That's good. The alternative, whoever asked this question, would you like to sing that song? No, you better sing. You're very good. No, very good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah, a lot of the time, even just talking about it will disappear and go. Simply because when it's hidden, it has more power. And when you tell someone about it, it's, well, this lady once, and she was dying of cancer. And so, you know, I was counselling her at the end. And one of the things I did is, what's the worst thing you've ever done in your life? I asked her. She was in her 60s or 70s. And it's nice to actually tell someone before you die. And then I finally got it out of her. I did say, I'm not going to tell anybody about it. You can tell me what it is. I think I did get permission afterwards to tell people about it. And she said, in her life, many years, she was married. Once she kissed somebody else's husband. I said, was that it? Is that the worst you've done? That's pretty good. Of all those years you've lived. And she said, really? Because she felt so guilty about it because she hadn't told anybody. And inside her head, she was amplifying it. It's just, you know, terrible, terrible, terrible things he did, and she'd go to some hell realm or something and be punished. Instead of just realizing it was a mistake, yeah. But that's all you've done. That's like 99 out of 100. That's a pretty good life you've lived. Well done. So by telling somebody else, by getting it from deep inside the torture chamber of shame and guilt, bringing it out and letting people know, and that doesn't hurt as much. It's like you realize it's not that bad. So, never mind. But tomorrow, maybe you get a better song. And then I might ask you to sing it. Okay, enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.